Good morning. This is Dr. Douglas Beck. I'm an audiologist, and you're listening to the Hearing Matters podcast. Today, we're interviewing Dr. David Moore. David has been Director of Communication Sciences Research at Cincinnati Children's Hospital and Professor of Otolaryngology and Neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati since 2012. Research interests include listening skills in children, speech perception and noise, large-scale studies of hearing and hearing health delivery to underserved populations. Born and educated in Melbourne, Australia, he has worked for over 40 years in the United Kingdom at the University of Oxford, the MRC Institute of Hearing Research in Nottingham, and currently the University of Manchester. In 2015, he received the Career Award of the American Academy of Audiology, and he's grateful to have been funded by national sources in the UK and the US continuously throughout his career. All of that said, hi, David. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Doug. Good to be here.
And my understanding, you just came back from, you were in Arizona, you were chairing one of the sessions on artificial intelligence at the American Auditory Society?
I was, yes.
Can you tell me a little about that? Did you learn anything particularly new, or did you teach things that were new? What were the takeaways that you left the AAS with?
So I think the most important takeaway was the final talk delivered by our good friend Brian Moore.
Brian, yeah.
No relation. He was talking about how much hardware was needed in order to get really good noise reduction in hearing aids, which we can't currently cram into a behind-the-ear instrument. But he pointed out that a cell phone is so powerful now that he thinks we're right on the edge of being able to do that task and in the right amount of time to deliver really substantial noise reduction.
That would be an incredible thing. I mean, we've had things like deep neural networks that have come out, which have been trained on human voices, and that's been a huge step forward. We've got, obviously, we've got amplitude modulation noise reduction. We've got directional mics. We've got a lot of tools now, but we are still quite a ways away from actual noise reduction in a cocktail party being incredibly effective, right?
Well, that's not the message I came away with from.
Tell me.
He spent a lot of time talking about the difficulty of doing that, but he did say that one group, that of Dr. Eric Healy, just up the road from me in Columbus, Ohio, was able to do very good noise reduction, but he said you needed a computer as big as the room that we were sitting in.
Yeah, that's the issue. But the thing is, you know, most of the cocktail party effect, the biggest issue is that the people that you want to listen to, the people you want to pay attention to, are making sounds exactly like the people you don't, right? If we were only talking about could we reduce fluorescent lights, could we reduce steady state computer fan noise, of course we can do that. That we've made tremendous progress with. But I think people are still looking for that ability to be in a cocktail party and have the hearing aid know who you want to pay attention to.
Right. Well, so the issue has been, of course, that directional microphones, you know, take you away from those other sources of sound. And I think the difference with AI is that we can just get better specification of individuals, which will enable us to do that, perhaps with some directionality, but still allowing other voices to come in.
And part of that, if I recall from a few years ago, was training the hearing aid to one person's voice. For instance, if you and I were going to go have a beer, which would be a nice thing, I could have you say 10 words or something. The hearing aid would pick up on your voice. And then when we're in the bar, it would know to amplify that particular voice, right?
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, we're just sort of ramping up from that sort of simple premise. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds great. And I hope that the hardware continues to shrink so we can actually do this in our lifetime. You know, we've been on the verge of these things for many decades, and I absolutely think we're closer than ever. That's all good. But I just the problem that I have with directional mics, and it's a problem I think that all patients and all professionals have, is, you know, the directional mic is dependent on the azimuth, and it's supposed to be the mics facing this way. What happens, I'm going to say 9 out of 10 times, people wear their hearing aids back here, so the directional mic is pointing up to the trees. Am I wrong on that?
No, that's not that. That is the case, but of course you can put directional mics somewhere other than on the hearing aid. And right. You know, you're wearing glasses at the moment, fine place to put them is on the edge of both of your lenses on your glasses. So
absolutely. And there's a lot of new glasses that have all sorts of directional features to aid amplification. So that's come a long way in a short period of time.
Right. And Christy Miller, who was one of the other speakers there, who's from Meta, was actually talking about the Meta glasses, which have microphones positioned at those places, as well as eye monitoring and all sorts of other gadgets.
Yeah, this is brilliant stuff. And I think it's going to change the entire outlook of how we do amplification over the next 5 to 10 years, because we have so much, we have so many better tools, and these tools are becoming much more sophisticated very rapidly. But the thing is, can we contain the costs, and can we make them commercially available? Because, you know, right now, when you look at the USA, you're looking at insurance companies are so critically important to people accessing hearing health care. But I don't see them saying, yes, you know, if a pair of glasses that you can hear perfectly are $12,000, let's do that. I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing what's the least expensive product we can put on somebody to make sounds louder. But that's a long way from making sounds clearer.
Yes, it is. But I mean, since we're into this subject, maybe I could say that one way around that is to make hearing aids part of what a general product available to the company, to the public would want, you know, to everyone, whether they're hearing impaired or not. So, you know, Apple's just released their new VR goggles, which have a lot of really desirable properties. Meta, I was talking about, I think these sort of companies are going to be hard to beat in the future when it comes to, you know, providing that sort of benefit, and hearing aids will possibly just be one of a variety of things you'll be able to do with these glasses.
I think that's a good observation. I'll tell you, between Meta and Apple, you know, you quite literally have billions of dollars of R&D, which the hearing aid companies have struggled for decades to do. I mean, it's extraordinarily expensive. And then people, when they see the final product, they say, that's $5,000. I could build that in my garage. No, you can't. And it took decades, and it's very, very advanced features. But people don't get that. They want the quick and easy, and they want cheap. And so I think this is always an issue. But speaking about making things clearer rather than louder, one of the papers you wrote, this goes back to 2014, and you wrote with a couple of my friends, Pierce Dawes and Kevin Monroe, and you guys were looking at the older adults' declining cognitive processing ability. And you said that was associated with a reduced ability to understand speech and noise. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So that particular study was part of a UK biobank, which at the time it was launched, UK Biobank is one of these mass population sort of everything about your health type studies.
Sure.
There's one going on right now in the US that I'm in called All of Us. And I have a Fitbit watch, which is monitoring all my physical activities of that. But so UK Biobank got into this game in the 2000s. And it's a longitudinal study involving over 500,000 people, 40 to 70 years of age. And I'm a participant as well as a scientist working on this project. So what we did in that paper was we measured for the first time in such a large-scale study somebody's ability to do a speech and noise task. And the speech and noise task was digits in noise, because that's a very simple task. You know, everybody, even 4 or 5 year old children, or you know, very old people, know the digits from 0 to 9. And so it takes away a lot of the cognitive aspects of most speech and noise tasks, but
it
does
language processing as well. I mean, when you what you're trying to get to with the digits and noise is a very, very simple auditory signal. So you're removing the patient's psychological, emotional, cognitive processes. You're just trying to get a raw processed signal.
Yeah, and in fact, at the time that, you know, we developed that test, the main idea was that it would be a proxy for an audiogram.
Sure.
So it turns out that the pure tone average correlates quite well with the speech reception threshold,
sure,
which is the output measure of the digits and noise test. I mean, to an R level of about 0.8. But going back to that paper, despite the fact that it's such a simple task, it still has a fairly significant cognitive load attached to it. And one of the benefits of combining the hearing tests with all the other tests that were done in UK Biobank, of which cognitive testing was the biggest load, was our ability then to see what the relationship is between those two different modes of understanding. And so what we showed was essentially that there is a relationship between speech reception threshold and your cognitive ability, but it was particularly important for people in the bottom 20% of the population in terms of cognitive abilities.
And what did you find based on that? So they did a speech and noise test, and the people who did the worst on the speech and noise, which was the digits and noise, actually, what did you correlate that with?
So we correlated that with a battery, you know, a composite score, which was a battery of cognitive tests. So things like attention, memory, processing speed, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
Intelligence.
Executive function, visuospatial.
Yeah. All that sort of stuff. And we found that there was a close correlation, but it was not a linear one. So as I was just saying, the people in the bottom 20% of the cognitive score ladder did up to 2 dB worse on the speech reception threshold than those in the higher cognitive gain group.
So I thought in that 2014 paper, what you found is that the people who had the worst digits and noise SRTs were at a higher risk for cognitive decline.
Yeah, well, we may have speculated that. I can't quite remember. But what I do know now is there is increasing evidence for that connection. So it turns out that in recent years, there's quite a bit of evidence now accumulating that there is a relationship between hearing ability and cognitive decline in a sort of medical sense. So, you know, in the sense of people having dementia.
And rather substantial, because following up on your biobank participation, Stevenson, and I think this was in 2022, it might have been 2023, he and his group were looking at, it was 81 or 82,000 people, and they were adults ages 60 and above, something like that. But they followed them for 10 to 12 years, and they said that the people who had the worst speech and noise scores had a 0.61 hazard ratio for developing dementia or dementia-like signs and symptoms 10 to 12 years later. So when you talk about a hazard ratio of 0.61, that doesn't mean that they have mild cognitive impairment or that they have Alzheimer's, but that means that over the 10 to 12 years period of time, 0.61 or 61% of those people who were at risk because they had a poor speech and noise result, they were the ones most likely to develop the signs and symptoms of mild cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's disease, and/or related disorders.
Let's take a quick break. Running a private practice is challenging, and it's especially difficult if you're using a management software system that's out of date or doesn't really fit your needs. As a former private practice owner, I personally found Cycle to be such an incredible tool that is easy to use and is really in the best interest of my patients. Cycle provides you with industry-specific workflows and features for a smooth-running front office, and if you've been listening to the Hearing Matters podcast, you will know that I believe that the front office staff is really the most important position in a hearing care clinic. Learn more at cycle.com. That's S-Y-C-L-E.com. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
That's right. And one of the featured sessions at the AAS meeting I've just come back from was on the ACHIEVE study, which is being led by Frank Lin and his colleagues at Johns Hopkins, and they showed a variety of different lines of evidence, including speech and noise, and very interestingly for me, brain structure, which were related to the use of hearing aids during later life.
And basically, I think the theory, I wasn't there, but I think that Frank has been saying for a number of years now, that people with untreated hearing loss, there is a certain amount of brain shrinkage that goes on, right? And people who were fitted successfully with hearing aids, they didn't have that same loss of neuronal capacity.
That's correct. I mean, we've known for a while that, you know, people with profound hearing loss do have, you know, some brain shrinkage in the thinking parts of the brain, you know, the cognitive processing areas. And they've shown that in this case, hearing aids can partly ameliorate that shrinkage.
Which is brilliant in many respects. And if you go back to the Hannah Glick paper with Anna Sharma, just a few years ago, I guess it was 2020 in Trends in, was it Trends in Amplification? Anyway, they published this brilliant paper, Glick and Sharma, where they looked at fitting people with hearing aids professionally with real ear measures, test box, proper clinical protocols that are in alignment with best practices. They did all that, and they found after 6 months, the brains physiologically changed. Early on, these people with hearing loss who had not been wearing hearing aids, their ABRs got smaller and smaller, and their visual evoked potentials got larger and larger. And the theory is that as the hearing became worse over years, they depended more on the visual signal to put together that communication receptive message. And then after 6 months of appropriate amplification with premium devices, they found the ABR went back to where it was supposed to go, and the visual evoked potential became smaller. And that, too, went back to more of a normal tracing. They found improvements in speech recognition. They found improvements with executive function and all of these other outcomes based on having professionally fitted premium products.
Right.
So that, you know, it's very impressive work. Because I think many, many people who are dealing with hearing aids just think of it as something that they're going to wear now and then to make things louder when they need it. But that's really not the best we can do. The approach that I've been advocating for about 35 or 40 years, and I think the approach you advocate, is to use the science in a best practice model. And that could be the best practice model from AAA or ASHER or IHS. But to professionally fit these things makes a huge difference in the anatomy and as well as in the physiology over the long term.
Yeah, I mean, we need to express a little bit of caution because there was an important caveat in the ACHIEVE's results, and yeah, that was only the people who had, you know, more developed forms of hearing loss showed these changes.
Yeah, the people at highest risk were the ones who had the most benefit.
That's right.
So you wouldn't necessarily say, you know, a 45-year-old with a mild high-frequency loss, and if he or she happens to be a PhD in neurophysiology, they're probably not at as much of a risk as somebody in a lower socioeconomic group with less education, with multiple comorbidities. I think what the ACHIEVE study said is that when you had people who were most at risk, perhaps somebody in a lower socioeconomic group, somebody with multiple comorbidities, somebody who had very significant hearing loss, they were the ones who benefited most from amplification. It wasn't the 35-year-old PhD in electrical engineering who saw that same benefit because he or she did not have the same risk factors.
Yeah. But, of course, there's an important lesson there, which is, you know, get screened, measure your hearing, certainly when you're approaching or in middle age.
Yeah.
And maybe we can take, you know, preventative steps.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's coming in the future, I think. Right now, we don't have enough solid science to say that this is a thing. We have a lot of science that says this is very important. We need to look at this further. But I don't think we're at the point where we're going to say anything about causation. This is strictly a correlational situation.
Well, I think that one of the things the ACHIEVE study achieved was to show that that it was a causal connection, at least in their population, because it was a double-blind randomized control trial. And, you know, it was powered exactly to establish that.
Well, that's a good
issue.
Caveat. I appreciate your saying that.
Yeah. But having said that, I mean, you're absolutely right that we need more evidence before we commit the huge resources that will be needed to give like a universal middle-aged hearing screen like we do for newborn infants at the moment.
Right, right. Number one, you and I were throwing around the term speech reception threshold earlier. And for clinical audiologists and hearing aid dispensers, nodalaryngologists, we're not talking about the SRT based on Spondees, upstairs, downtown, baseball, hot dog. We're not talking about that. When we say the SRT, the speech reception threshold, in this regard, we're talking about it as sort of an SNR 50, which is the signal to noise ratio to get 50% of the words correct. And I think it's important that we draw that line because I think a lot of people get confused on this. If they're not used to speech and noise or signal to noise ratio issues, they assume we're talking about a different SRT. So the SRT that we're talking about is actually sometimes called an SRT in the speech and noise literature. Sometimes it's an SRT 50. Sometimes it's an SNR 50. They all mean the same thing. But we're talking about the signal to noise ratio for someone to get half the words correct, which is very much like the Hewson-Westlake pure tone protocol, where we go above and below a pure tone to say this is the 50% point where the patient responds correctly. And it's very much the same with an SRT in this regard. We might vary the background noise to where it's impossible for them to tell what the primary word is, and then we make it easier and we bracket that. So I just wanted to allow a little clarification on that. The other thing I'd like to address, David, you said we should get screened, and I don't want to take you to task on that, but I have an issue which I've written about extensively on screening. I don't believe in screening anybody except newborn infants. I think, and there, I think it's critically important. I think for an adult, you see, when you and I talk about screening, you're talking about digits and noise, but the rest of the world is talking about pure tone. Press the button when you hear the beep. So I don't want to take you to task. I don't want to call you, but I want to say that your screening is a far more comprehensive audiometric evaluation. You don't mean just a pure tone screening, is my understanding. Am I correct on that?
That's right. I mean, I think that the audiogram does have a lot of interesting things to say, but it shouldn't be the only index that we use. And, right. You know, speech and noise, everyone says that, you know, that's what patients complain about when they go to see an audiologist. They don't complain about their inability to hear quiet tones in a sound booth.
Exactly right. So that's the thing, is that if we follow a best practice model, we're going to be doing comprehensive audiometric evaluations. That's already in print by IHS, by AAA, by ASHA, that their best practice model includes a speech and noise test, as well as a listening and communication assessment, as well as all the diagnostics. So when we're talking about screening, I don't want people to think, oh, we'll do a pure tone screening and see if there's an issue. No, you got to do all of it. If you're just doing the greatest hits of audiology, you're not going to see these things. These deficits will be invisible to you because you won't be picking up those speech and noise problems.
Right.
David, before I let you go, and you've been very generous with your time, I'd like you to address one issue here. Many people, I think, are confusing in our profession, industrial noise and noise and leisure noise and things like that. I know you have some strong opinions on leisure noise versus perhaps industrial or military noise. Can you address that for me?
Yeah. So I have some strong opinions because the World Health Organization announced in its World Report on Hearing a couple of years ago that 1 billion young people were in danger of, destroying their hearing by listening to portable music players. And that's a really strong statement. And I've been involved in a number of research studies, and there are a number of other ones out there that I haven't been involved in that have found actually when you measure people's hearing abilities, I mean, using speech and noise or using audiometry, that, and you then compare that with their self-reported levels of noise exposure, then you just don't get that relationship. We have tremendous difficulty showing any relationship between hearing level and history of noise exposure. So just to tell you about one study that I did in Manchester with Piers and Kevin and other colleagues there, we went to in Manchester, there's an institution called the Royal Northern College of Music, which is one of the premier music colleges in the UK. And typically the students there who are in their 20s, people who've been playing musical instruments for hours a day over, you know, a 10 or 15 year period. And so we argued that since we know that, you know, older people who've played in a symphony orchestra for all their life are at increased level of hearing loss.
Sure,
I don't think there's any argument about that.
Yep.
That these young people who've had such a massive noise exposure might have hearing loss even at that stage of their life. And the answer to that question was, no, they don't. And actually, you know, we did this as also as part of the UK Biobank study that I talked about before in that 2014 paper.
Sure.
There was a question there about, you know, do you have, you know, leisure noise exposure and how much? And similarly, do you have occupational noise exposure and how much? The occupational noise exposure over many years undoubtedly, you know, does ding your hearing.
Yeah, sure.
But the leisure noise exposure did not.
It's very interesting, and it puts it into context that, you know, you can't just cherry pick data from one situation and apply it to another. You know, these have to be data that are gathered appropriately for the application.
Yeah. And one thing I could say about that is that, you know, I am talking in generalizations here. There are certain forms of leisure noise which we're pretty sure are damaging.
Oh, sure.
I mean, things like firearms,
yep.
Possibly motor racing,
yep.
You know, where there's really intense levels of noise for even a short period of time. I mean, Stephen Neely and his colleagues recently had a paper in Ear and Hearing saying that it's possible that even a single gunshot exposure can damage your hearing.
Oh, sure.
And they even speculated in that paper that this might be a leading reason why men in the US in particular have poorer sound thresholds than women do.
Yeah, and impulse noise, you know, when you're talking about 160, 170, 180, you know, you can have a traumatic effect immediately. And I think that's totally true. But I think that when you're talking about leisure noise in general, you might be talking about snowmobiling for an hour once a winter or driving a motorcycle. You know, I drove motorcycles for 50 years, and many of them have been Harley Davidsons. But the truth of the matter is, you're not sitting there going, you know, for hours on end. I mean, you know, that's a 12-second event. And the sound is behind the driver. It's not coming into my. So I think that there's room to still explore leisure noises. I do think that you're exactly right. When we're talking about explosive noises, when you're talking about munitions, you got to be careful because you don't know. And a gun could misfire, cause physical problems, but also acoustically, it depends on the environment you're in. I can go out to a range and shoot with headphones and earmuffs and all of that. And it's still loud. It's not, you know, 180 dB, but maybe we'll get it down to a level that a few 15, 20, 25 rounds isn't going to be damaging to your hearing for the long term. But again, you never know. And everybody's susceptibility is different. So this is a huge factor that we don't often discuss. But, you know, you have people who've been professional musicians for decades, like Peter Townsend, who has a severe to profound loss. But then you have other people who've been professional musicians for decades who don't. And so it's not just your noise exposure, but it's also your individual susceptibility.
Right. I think that individual susceptibility is a fascinating issue and one that we're pursuing with the UK Biobank genetic database, because one of the things we did in as part of that study is we had a blood draw taken.
Yeah.
And recently they've finished getting the whole genome sequencing of all of the 500,000 people who were part of that study, which was just an incredible and incredibly expensive undertaking. But the UK Biobank had been so successful in bringing out all sorts of health-related, you know, lifestyle issues and other things that they figured, and when I mean they, I'm talking about a public-private enterprise, they all figured that it was worthwhile doing those full genomes. What that will give us the ability to do, of course, is to look for connections between, you know, what you're endowed with genetically at birth and all these other sorts of issues that can go wrong with your hearing. And I think we've got a tremendous opportunity here to come out with, you know, a quadrupling or even a an order of magnitude, a tenfold increase in the number of genetic loci that we know are affected by aspects of hearing.
David, I know you're not an audiologist by training, but you know a little bit about audiology, and you deal with a lot of doctoral students and a lot of doctors of audiology. And I'm wondering your perspectives on the profession, our educational systems, and where that's all going.
So, yeah, I've had a lot of experience with this, and my wife, who is an audiologist, and I often have discussions about this because, you know, we're in the business of trying to recruit people to come into research, and we teach in audiology classes here at University of Cincinnati. And so I think, you know, my perspective is that audiology is a science, and it's really important we get really high caliber scientific people coming into the profession.
Sure.
And I sometimes wonder whether we're going about that the right way, particularly in the US, where the typical route into an audiology, an AUD program, is via a speech and hearing undergraduate program, which you would think might be a very good way in. And I'm not dissing that at all. But in research, we often have people with backgrounds in disciplines like physics, engineering, mathematics, psychology, biology, all of which have a very strong sort of underpinning in the scientific method. And that is tremendously useful, I think, not just for research, but for understanding the sort of developments and implementing them, or conversely being skeptical about them, with all the sorts of things we've been talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really important point, I think. Listen, communicative disorders and sciences is wonderful. I'm so glad I got my degree there. But this is my bachelor's degree before, when I was going through all of this 40 years ago, you got a bachelor's in, as you said, in communicative disorders and sciences, then a master's in audiology, and that's all you needed to practice. And then 20 years later, I went on and got my doctorate. But the thing is that as somebody who has published a great deal and have worked on a lot of scientific committees, my undergraduate education has not been very useful, to be honest. Things like learning about the speech mechanisms. Well, that's fine. That's very important. I'm not dissing that, but it might have been wiser to spend more time on neuroscience. It might have been wiser to learn more about cardiac and general medical conditions. Might have been wise. We did human brain dissections. I was very fortunate because I was in Jack Katz's lab, so we got to do that. But most audiologists don't do that. And I think the people who do that have a much better understanding of the gestalt, right? The entire human central nervous system, because you've seen it, you've touched it, you've worked with it. And I don't think there's a replacement for that. I think I was in math and sciences. So the background of statistics has helped me enormously throughout my career, much more so than knowing about phonemes. Now, there's nothing wrong with phonemes, but I want to underscore the point that you're making, is that a more scientific education would only improve the profession, I think.
If I can just say something specific about my own experience, I mean, my background was in physiology, which is what sort of subsumed became more neuroscience. Sure. With the passing years, and in psychology. And I also did some math at college level as well. And the most useful part of all of that was the psychology, undoubtedly, because that's where I learned about the scientific method. That's sure. where I learned about what hypotheses are and how you test them and, you know, how you therefore evaluate the quality overall of a scientific paper.
And it's very important because everybody can publish, everybody can write, but it's so important that you write well and that you're reasoning these things out before you start doing the experiment, before you start seeing the patients, lay out the project, have your colleagues look at it, make sure you're gathering what you think you're gathering and that you're gathering it in such a way that the data at the end of the study can be used to determine useful information. Oftentimes, you know, you'll do a study of 30, 40, 50, 70 people, and you'll have some people who you have this information on, some people you have that information on. had you paid attention to the scientific method from the beginning, you would have had a control and an experimental group. You would have had random control trials. You would have had data gathered in such a way that it could easily be transcribed into a functional outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And tell me lastly, what about the cost of education for an audiology doctorate in 2024? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not an expert in that field at all, but I think that, you know, one of the things that's happened recently, of course, is a lot of the AUD programs have been shortened to 3-year programs. That's fine if you can get in everything you need to in that time. That's obviously reduced the cost. But I think maybe what you're alluding to is what happens as you advance through your career. And I think one of the issues that Lisa, my wife, and I talk about a lot is, you know, the professionalism of audiology compared with another other allied disciplines like optometry, for example, where the, you know, the mean salary level is there's quite a disparity there.
Yeah.
And I think that that audiology needs to perhaps put more effort into, you know, advancing the profession in a way that would lead to equity with other health sciences, including medicine. You know?
Yeah, of course. And I think that if we had more of a scientific background that was recognized as a scientific background, that would go a long way, because when you think about it, optometrists, chiropractors, podiatrists, optometrists, they're physicians. They are looked at as physicians. Audiologists are not. They can prescribe. We cannot. So, and I think the it's not that they're smarter or any such thing, but their educational basis leads to those conclusions. And I think that ours currently does not. And I think that these are things that we need to address probably rapidly, you know, within the next 2 to 5 years. That said, I know it's been tried. I know that many of us over the last few decades have said, why do we not prescribe medicines? Why do we not get recognition as physicians in our disciplines? And these are not easy problems to solve, but they have to be solved if we're going to have a stronger scientific basis. The benefits of that will be shown in our patient care and our respect and our authority to better manage patients.
Yeah, and I think one of the other aspects of the profession is that, you know, when we go to our lawyer or we go to even our doctor, much of the work is done by assistants who are, you know, less well-trained people typically, who are nevertheless able to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And I think there could be much more of that in the audiology profession as well.
Yeah.
I mean, this leads on to the question of, you know, over-the-counter hearing aids versus bespoke hearing aid fitting by an audiologist. And I'm actually in favor of audiologists playing a big role in continuing to play a big role in hearing aid fitting. But perhaps they could, you know, take that role in a more specialist and more sort of nuanced way than they currently do. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there, I think, for task sharing among less qualified individuals.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You go to any dentist's office, you know, a modern dentist's office, you're going to have a dental hygienist or 6 of them. You're going to have dental technicians. You're going to have one dentist. And that dentist goes and does the most sophisticated things at the right time in the right room for the right.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing, I think, makes a lot of sense for the patients. It's much more efficient. When you go back to this model of having more assistants, I think that gives us more financial flexibility as well for the office and for the patient. Because when you have dental technicians, dental hygienists, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, when you have these people who are all working in concert with a physician, that does tend to allow the physician, he or she, to focus on the most important, most critical needs of the patient at that moment. But we don't really need the physician to be doing things like teeth cleaning. We don't really need the physician to be doing things like removing earwax from an ear canal. I mean, audiologists, hearing aid dispensers, lots of people do this kind of work, and they've been trained to do that. Now, There's nothing wrong with a physician doing it, but is it really the best and most efficient use of his or her time?
Quite so. And even in the research domain where I work, you know, we have a lot of research assistants and clinical research coordinators who really do most of the work. I mean, most of the seeing of the research participants and a lot of auditory testing, you know, complex stuff. And obviously, you know, they get quite a bit of training when they come to us, typically from an undergraduate degree background. But, you know, we oversee the whole thing and make sure that they're doing it correctly. And then, of course, it's up to us to interpret the results and write the papers and generally to communicate it to the rest of the world.
Yeah, which makes total sense. All right, Dr. David Moore, I want to thank you for your time. And it's always a joy to speak to you. I learn something every time we chat. And thank you for your participation in the Hearing Matters podcast. And I wish you a wonderful day.
You too, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again for tuning into the Hearing Matters podcast today. I'm your host, Blaise Delfino, and on behalf of our entire team, thank you so much for the support. Truly, it means so much to us. Head on over to the Apple Podcast app and share your thoughts. What did you like most about this episode, and what do you like most about our podcast? 5-star reviews are always appreciated. And also, head on over to Instagram, hit that follow button, and let's connect. And as a team, we can continue to help our community hear life's story.